name is Jane Pacheco, and I work with the Interfaith Council for Peace and Justice. I'm going to call myself a facilitator tonight in place of a moderator. The moderator we had actually hoped that would be here with us tonight, George Lambertes from Interfaith Roundtable, is under the weather. So we're holding him in our thoughts for speedy recovery. And I will be here with you tonight and our panelists. First of all, I want to just thank Tim and the Ann Arbor District Library for hosting us this evening. This is the second panel discussion that we've held at the library. The first was wonderful, and we're hoping for a great discussion tonight. I also want to thank our participating congregations, our participants at those congregations, as well as all of the individuals that have helped us with this programming, and you all for coming out tonight to hear about our program and our panelists speak. So tonight's program is based on some of our participating congregations have read or have been reading this book, Faith and Food, Changing the World One Meal at a Time. In January, we talked a little bit about broad links between sacred texts of different faith traditions and how they connect, how we think, and what we believe about food systems, the food that we eat and how it's connected to our faith tradition. Tonight we're going to be talking a little bit more focused in terms of how these communities are making meaningful impact within the community, locally, regionally, nationally, globally, in the impact in terms of the food system as it relates to hunger advocacy, workers' rights, farmers' rights, the environmental impact of what we choose to eat and how we choose to live. So I would like to go dive right in and introduce our first speaker tonight. His name is Yusuf Saloom, and he is a member of the Islamic Center of Ann Arbor. He is a law student at the University of Michigan and a longtime Michigan resident. He has been involved with Islamic education and interfaith dialogue for over 10 years and sees interfaith discussions as a great forum for fostering mutual understanding and appreciation of different human perspectives. He is also a big fan of the outdoors, hiking, and mountain climbing. So welcome, Yusuf.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Jane and the ICPJA, for hosting this great event, and also thank you to the Ann Arbor District Library for providing this great forum for us. So to start off with, you know, I know I'm going to definitely jump into some of the different ways the Islamic community is tackling issues related to food justice, but I'd like to take a step back for a second. When Jane told me about this event, I was originally trying to understand the link between food and justice, two ideas that might seem a little different at first glance. Food, you know, the tangible activity that we engage in multiple times a day, something we can easily grasp. Then you have justice, it's an ideal, something that's intangible, something that we may think about but might not intuitively attach to food. So I want us to keep that in mind in the back of our heads as I go through this dialogue today. What is the relationship between food and justice? And how does faith inform that? The way I like to think about religion is the ultimate relationship guide. It tells you how to have a relationship with God, how to have a relationship with your spouse, your family, fellow human beings of the same religious orientation, of different religious orientations. And it goes beyond that. It tells you how to have a relationship with animals. How do you treat and deal with animals, plants, and the earth? In fact, it even goes further and tells you how to deal with future generations that aren't even around at this point. God in the Quran, the Islamic holy book, describes the role of human beings on this planet as his vicegerent, as his representative here on earth. It's not just ours for our own consumption and use during our lives. It's our idea, it's our goal, it's our objective to treat it as something that we would take care of, not only for us, for the other inhabitants, such as the animals and plants, that we have been given responsibility over. So one way of thinking about this relationship, this is a rights and responsibilities framework. And so this framework of rights and responsibilities entails that some things that you are owed, your rights, and then responsibilities, things that you owe to the other beings around you. So part of that, rights and responsibilities, is easy to understand in our relationship with other human beings. But when you're thinking about food, we need to think beyond just human beings. A lot of the food environment is it's part of the soil. It can be different animals that are either used for tilling or for consumption. And in the Islamic tradition, there are two interesting hadiths or sayings of the Prophet, peace be upon him, that I'd like to share with you that address this rights and responsibilities framework. The first one is a hadith or a saying about ihsan. Ihsan can be roughly translated as excellence or perfection. In this saying, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, is telling us that ihsan or excellence is prescribed upon you in everything that you do. Either if you're going to work, in your relationship with your spouse, in your relationship with your children, no matter what it is you're doing, you should strive for excellence. But further along in the saying, when it came time to give an example of how to actually carry out this excellence, he didn't talk about prayer. He didn't say, make sure you pray as best to your abilities. Or, you know, make sure when you give money, you do it with the purest of intentions, all of which are very important things. When it came time to talk about excellence, he said, when you deal with animals, deal with them the most excellent manner. When you are going to slaughter an animal for consumption, make sure you treat that animal nicely. Make sure your knife is as sharp as possible. This is what excellence embodies. In another saying, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, witnessed some travelers who had arrived to their destinations, and they were traveling on horseback. Upon arriving to their destination, they nonetheless remained on their horses and just carried out conversation, something that doesn't seem on its face too wrong. They were just relaxing after their long journey, but were nonetheless still on horseback. The Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, approached them and said, you should dismount from the horses. You rode in peace, now let them be in peace. Perhaps the ones that are being ridden are better than the riders in their remembrance towards God. Through these two different sayings, we can understand that just as our goal or our objective as God's representatives here on earth is to take care of each other, it further extends beyond that to include animals and the earth as well, two very important components of food and justice. So now having this rights and responsibilities framework, we can see how faith, through faith, food actually becomes the optimal mechanism for understanding justice, because food touches on so many different relationships. When you're eating food, in the Muslim faith, you start out by remembering God. That's your relationship with God. You should eat with other people. That's your relationship with your family. You should, in the Islamic faith, you're not allowed to just eat while your neighbor goes hungry. That's your relationship with your community. When you eat, as I mentioned in the hadith about excellence, you're supposed to make sure that that animal was treated as best as possible, or that the earth, that you took care of the earth before taking the crops from it. That's your relationship with the plants and the animals. One specific, very famous and probably well known to you all, example of food in Islam is the fasting month of Ramadan. Ramadan is a roughly 30-day period, month long, once a year, where Muslims fast from sunup to sundown. This is, I could say it's a training period. It's a 30-day long period, but our relationships that I was discussing, be it with food, with animals, with God, with our fellow brothers and sisters in humanity, is a year-round obligation. It doesn't only last for a month. So through those 30 days, we train ourselves to better understand the hunger that our fellow brothers and sisters that don't have food go through on a daily basis. We might be looking forward to a nice meal at the end of the day, but there are many, many people who fast every day without looking forward to a meal at the end of the day. And by understanding only a little bit of their pain, we can better motivate ourselves to work towards helping our fellow brothers and sisters in humanity. Another idea that has recently started in the Muslim community, specifically here in Ann Arbor, and actually in Michigan and the country as a whole, has been following the recent murders of the three youth in North Carolina. Something that was very important to them was feeding homeless people and those less fortunate than us in the community. That has taken on a much more important role in the Muslim community following their passing. And we launched an initiative called Feeding Their Legacy, which involves Muslims in community service, not just for the Muslim community, but for our neighborhoods at large, where we often underestimate the poverty within our own areas. So I guess to wrap up and to conclude this, I'd like to, again, understand and try to convince us that this relationship with food, justice, and faith is just as important as the relationships that we view with other human beings. Through food, the optimal mechanism for understanding justice, we can think about a lot of different, you know, relationships with God, with the animals, the plants, and even the workers who might be pulling these crops out in faraway countries that we never see, who nonetheless might be living on very minimal wages when all we see is the food at the end of that on our table. By keeping in mind these relationships, we understand where food fits in the global picture of justice, this global picture of rights and responsibilities, this framework that allows us to better understand food in the larger context of faith. Thank you.
Thank you, Yusuf. Our next speaker is Ryan.
I'm gonna try.
I've been saying it wrong for like a year now. Booze?
Close enough. It's amazing.
Okay.
Progress.
Ryan is a pastor of Family and Youth Ministries at Ann Arbor Christian Reformed Church. He's pursuing a doctorate of ministry at Western Theological Seminary, in which he is exploring the creation of a holistic, reformed, Eucharistic practice through the lens of food ethics. And that is a mouthful. But when I first met Ryan, many people in the ICPJ community said, you need to talk to him. He is crazy about food. And we met about a year ago now in preparation for some of the programming that ICPJ has focused on this year in terms of food injustice. And he's been a panelist for us on a few of our programs, and we're glad to have him here tonight to talk about his beliefs. Thanks.
Thank you. So yeah, thank you, Jane, and thank you, everybody. It's great to be here. This is a blast for me to talk about this. I don't know how to take crazy about food exactly, but we're going to go with it. We're going to ride it, and I'm just thrilled to be here. What I would like to talk about is in the Christian tradition, we have a meal that's at the heart of what we're all about as followers of Jesus. And that is the table of our Lord, the table of the Eucharist, Lord's Supper, Communion, the Mass. And how are we tying table to table? Really, that's at the heart of where I think following Jesus, how we can enter this conversation about food ethics. How do we tie table to table? And I think that we can begin by talking about story. Story has certain power. The stories that we've been told growing up, the stories that we enter into, the stories we believe about ourselves, the stories that we believe about others, they hold tremendous power. And I think one of the stories which gets told to us here in this country is a certain story about food, about how it's supposed to work in our lives, the role that it's supposed to play in our lives. We have a food ethic of industrial farming that kind of dominates the landscape, where we are told that the values around this food ethic, this consumerism food ethic, are the values of fast, cheap, and easy. Those are the values that get communicated. We talk about production and harvest in terms of yield, in terms of how much we can go and can we keep getting more and more. And that is the story of food. For most of us, this is a utilitarian consumable, right? This is something that we don't think about until we sit down and we say, here we go. And for people of faith and for Christians, there is a responsibility to offer a different story. And I think that's where the table of our Lord can have a unique approach to that. So what I would like to propose is that there is something called a Eucharistic food ethic, and that is that there is a, in the table of our Lord, in the Eucharist, we have a model to follow from Jesus who gives of himself for the world. And this is what he offers. He takes bread and he takes wine and he says, this is my body, this is my blood, and it's for the world. It's for us. And then we in turn are having been fed and sustained and united with our Lord and with one another, are then invited to turn our actions outward and give of ourselves for the feeding of the world, that we may better the world in what we do. So this is the model that which my tradition operates on. And so having said that, then, there is this different story, a Eucharistic food ethic versus a consumerist food ethic, which demands that we tie table to table, that we think about the table of our Lord when we gather around our dining room tables, when we go out for coffee, when we, wherever we are, where we are eating, we are engaging with the story of Jesus. And so what does that look like? The model that I think that I would offer is to say that every meal that we eat, whether that be a breakfast in our own home or an extravagant feast with friends and family, are a prelude and a echo to the meal that we share as followers of Jesus. They both, we might say, time collapses a bit, and it's a meal that runs up upon the meal of our Lord, and a meal that then echoes as we go into our week. And that demands that we engage with the world in an entirely new way. Suddenly the values of fast and easy and cheap are replaced with values of integrity and dignity. And so how we engage with the world, how we engage with animals, how we engage with plants, how we engage with the very soil, the very dust and earth underneath our feet, radically changes. We are tied to it and affixed to it. And so that is that's the model that's in and of itself a rejection of the consumerist model and a replacement with this Eucharistic model, that we tie table to table. A bit about what that looks like on the ground, and this is a chance that I get to brag a bit about my own community, although the good news is we're not unique. Is that we have in interfaith dialogue, one of the fantastic things is learning from and with different traditions. I go, hey, food is a place where we can really come together and get excited together about some of this stuff. And there are a lot of the same things that that will be mentioned around this table and have been mentioned by others tonight and other places are things that I can gladly echo and affirm as things that Christians can affirm and that things that we want to be about. Things like fighting hunger, things like giving, being there for workers' rights, things like addressing the impact that an industrial farming system has on our environment. All of those things we can affirm, but some things unique to our own community at Ann Arbor Christian is in this thing that we began called Fed as We Are Fed. And so it is in partnering with Hope Clinic in Ypsilanti, every Sunday where we celebrate Eucharist, we are invited to bring food that then can be distributed to Hope Clinic so that we can tie the feeding that we experience and the sustaining that we can experience at the table of our Lord and immediately have an impact on those that need that assistance to be fed and sustained in their own lives. We are part of the Faith and Food Garden, as many other communities are in this area, and what a joy that is, that we can watch God in God's providence provide food, and we can give that to food gatherers. We have challenged ourselves before at potlucks to see if we can only get locally and seasonally sourced ingredients. When we do that in February, by the way, that's hard. So, but we do okay. We do our best. Potatoes stay long, so that works. But wonderful things that we can engage in like that, and also evaluating our own communion practices. What does it mean to come to the table? How do we come to the table with integrity and with honesty? How do we come to the table as we have the Lord as our host? And what does that mean for us to go into our own homes? Who are we hosting? Who are we giving our lives to and for and with? And so, we are... we're thrilled to constantly learn in that, and we always love to lean into the Christian idea of grace as we do that, because whenever we talk about food, we learn things, and the more we learn, the more we go, oh, maybe I shouldn't be doing that, and how do we redirect, and how do we, you know, and we correct our mistakes, and we learn, and we commit ourselves to continually moving forward. So that's a bit about what we're doing. That's a bit about why we do it, We are seeking to always tie that table to table in the grace of our Lord. So, yeah.
Our next speaker is Rabbi Rob Dobberson, a familiar feature in our community. He's served as a rabbi at Beth Israel Congregation in Ann Arbor since 1988. He's a founding member of the Interfaith Roundtable of Washtenaw County and has served on the board of directors for several community agencies. Rabbi Dobberson is an active supporter of many different Jewish organizations and recently concluded his term as the national co-chair of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights. And I'm excited to hear this story. Rob has worked with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers through his work with TRUA, and we have some interesting local information to talk about as well as we hear this sort of origin story. So thanks, Rob.
Thank you, and it is a pleasure to be here. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here this evening. 2 weeks from tomorrow night, we're going to celebrate the beginning of the holiday of Pesach, the holiday of Passover. That's important because I think if this program were being held next week, I probably wouldn't be here because I'd be up to my neck and trying to clean things around the house, because the major thing that people think of who have a traditional Jewish home when they say Passover's coming is, oh, we've got all this cleaning to do. We've got all these special foods to buy. We've got to change all the dishes over and all of these kind of things. And it gets harder and harder as you get older and you don't have the kids around the house who used to carry the boxes up from downstairs. And that's what's occupying our mind when really, as important as that is, that shouldn't take the place of or stand in the way of thinking about what the holiday is really about. In our tradition, we like to combine, hopefully, ritual and action of that kind with remembering what the values, what the principles, and what the priorities and message of the holiday is. And the holiday of Passover is, in our tradition, a time to recognize our freedom and a time to celebrate an ancient story of freedom which we believe is eternal, namely the Exodus from Egypt. During the Seder meal, the meal on the first night, or in traditional homes, the first two nights of Passover, there's an interesting thing that's said, which is that the matzah, the unleavened bread, is lifted up, excuse me, at the beginning of the Seder meal, and one says the statement that is, this is the bread of affliction, which our ancestors ate in the land of Egypt. I'm going to skip over the middle of it for a minute and come back to it, but there's a line at the end which says, now we are slaves, this year we are slaves, next year may we be free. It's a very, very intriguing line because the entire message of the holiday is to celebrate freedom from slavery. So why then would we say at the beginning of the meal, this year we are slaves, now we are slaves, next year may we be free? And there's two ways to look at that. One is that the whole Seder experience is supposed to replicate that Exodus from Egypt. So at the beginning, you do, in essence, consider yourself a slave, and then you are freed, and then at the end of the evening, through celebration, as it grows, you celebrate freedom. That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it, I think, is much more important and much more influential in our lives, which is to say that as long as one person in the world is enslaved, we are all enslaved. And slavery exists. It exists in this country, it exists in other places, it exists in our community. And we have an obligation, not just at Passover time, and certainly not just Jews, all of us, to look at the issues of slavery and the issues of people who are oppressed in one form or another and say, what are we doing? What are we doing, and what are we doing to help that situation, and what are we doing to perpetuate that situation? That's what I want to talk about this evening. I'm proud of some of the things we do at the congregation, and I know that other congregations do them as well. We do have food drives, and we try to make sure that we're sensitive to those needs, and I'm not minimizing that at all. But I wanted to use my time tonight, and I know Jane had asked me, and in the introduction had asked me, to speak about this issue that I have been involved in through the organization TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, that we at the synagogue have been involved in with our social action committee, and with some people in particular who have made the trip that I was able to make 3 years ago down to Immokalee, Florida, which is the center of the tomato growing industry in Florida. And some of you might have seen the movie, which I'm blanking on the name, help me.
Food Chains,
thank you. I saw it just the other day. And there have been many documentaries that have been on TV, many news stories, et cetera, about, first of all, the terrible plight of workers in the tomato industry. Still to a point, but certainly worse a few years ago and before. There were so many stories of slavery, real, honest slavery. People not being able to leave the job when they didn't want to stay. People who were chained in railroad cars or whatever it is, and when they did work, being subject to abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, and working for a horribly a terrible wage and under horrible conditions. And the owners of the farms, in essence, had held all the cards. And these people, most of whom had no recourse in one way or another and had no other opportunity for employment, were literally killing themselves and putting themselves in great danger in order to make whatever money they could. Come along a group called the Interfaith Coalition of Immokalee Workers. And this group, and there's information about it outside, came up with this fantastic idea. And I'm going to read a paragraph here because it says it better than ever I could about what was called the Fair Food Program. The Fair Food Program is a unique farm worker and consumer-driven initiative consisting of a wage increase supported by a price premium paid by corporate purchasers of Florida tomatoes and a human rights-based code of conduct applicable throughout the Florida tomato industry. What this group did was they brought the workers, the farm owners, and the suppliers, and the retailers together and said, if you raise the price of tomatoes 1 cent a pound and pass that on to the workers, then what will happen will be, and you will only buy from the farms which use these workers and agreed part of this Fair Food Program, everybody will benefit. And the consumer, first of all, may not notice the difference, but even if they do, knowing that they are being part of a program to help people avoid what in essence is slavery is a fantastic thing. So our group, TRUA, the organization I'm involved in, is the Jewish participant, the major Jewish participant in this coalition. And brings rabbis down, I believe they brought about 50 or 60 rabbis who now are known as tomato rabbis, down to Florida to experience what this group did, not only to see the horrible conditions which people still live in, frankly, it's still not that much better, but at least it's more humane and there's progress. And people, the workers are protected from abuse and they're protected from working too hard for such a meager income. And what happens is now many, many retailers, grocery chains, restaurants, not Wendy's, okay, we have to mention that, have signed on to this Fair Food Agreement saying they will only buy tomatoes from these farms. Trader Joe's, just as an example, participated in it as of a couple of years ago, but there's a whole list of them and you can find it, I'm sure, on the internet, etc. And going down there and seeing this in action was just an incredible experience because we don't think about those people. We don't think about those people who are supplying our table, who are giving us our food. And this was a great opportunity. But more than that, it was a sign of hope. Whoever thinks that the farmers and the farm workers and the retailers could actually get together, it's not perfect. I don't want to pretend to you that everything is like, you know, oh, everybody's, you know, holding hands and smiling all the time. But every place that we went into several farms, there are signs in English and in Spanish saying rights, what people shouldn't stand for. There are ombudsmen, there are people, there are committees that watch over, and so the abuse has gone down, and the level of respect has gone up. Just one example. I want you to take a look at this, at the material that's out there. I'm very glad to be part of this, very glad to be able to tell this story. There's more to tell. The only thing I'll say to you is that a lot of people get out to Florida, and you know, they think of Florida as Disney World, they think of Florida as spring training baseball, they think of Florida as the beaches. This was an eye-opener, being there to see it. And I know a group is now down at a benefit concert that's taking place in St. Petersburg, Florida, for the CIW, the Coalition of Mockley Workers. The only thing I would hope is that somehow what they do can be replicated in other places, because that's what's really important. I'll just say one other quick thing, and that's that on Passover, as many of you know, our tables are filled with symbolic foods. Bitter herbs, horseradish usually, the matzah, the salt water to represent tears. Truan, our group, has urged people to put a tomato on the table as well as a symbol of modern-day slavery. And the idea is to say, this year we are slaves, and next year or the year after or sometime in our generation or our children's, we can eradicate this kind of slavery and pay more attention to where our food is coming from. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Rabbi. Just a few sentences to follow up with that, because I promised some exciting news about that. We are, ICPJ and several other local groups are working with a group here that is newly formed in Ann Arbor called Ann Arbor Fair Food. And it's being spearheaded by a U of M grad student by the name of Kim Daly. She was at the U of M Roth School of Business showing of food chains, if some of you had been to that event. And she's very excited and passionate about this work. She's been down to Florida, and she has asked ICPJ to help collaborate and coordinate some of the work that they're doing, but they're on their way right now in a very large bus down to a benefit concert for the CIW in St. Petersburg, I believe it is. And Kim was nice enough to drop off some information about the movement, about the background, and about some of the things that are happening in Ann Arbor. It is not out in the hall, but just at the very back of this room is that information. If you're signed up for the ICPJ Food Injustice emails, we are passing along that information, and we will be working on some action initiatives with that group in the future. Most recently, the biggest sort of most urgent initiative is we are working with Ann Arbor Fair Food to open conversation with the administration at U of M in terms of their contract with the Wendy's fast food chain. So they are one of only a handful of universities that still have a contract with Wendy's because of the pressure from the CIW. So if you're interested in that, please, you know, leave us your information, and we'll pass on info. So next up is, thank you, Rabbi, for that. Julie Ritter, who has been with us here before. She is a member of the Jewel Heart Buddhist Center, and for over 25 years, don't know, a long time Ann Arbor, but a real food person too, food injustice. 10 years ago, she was involved in the launch of Food System Economic Partnership, or FSEP for some of you that are familiar with that acronym. She's worked with local groups like Harvest Kitchen and Preserving Traditions, the Local Food Summit, Homegrown Festival, lots of things like that, and has used her faith and her understanding of Buddhist teachings as a springboard for her commitment to helping grow the local food community, and we're pleased to have her here with us tonight. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sitting here listening to all these stories is so inspiring. Food is a symbol of faith and commitment for every tradition around the world. I can't think of one that doesn't use food in some sacrificial ritual way. It's so important. There have been so many things talked about in the three meetings that I've been to and going to that movie about the farm workers in Florida. My mother, by the way, was one of the founding people many years ago of that movement. There's so many aspects of the local food movement, of food and faith and food traditions. There's the social justice for the farmers who are being squeezed out by globalized corporations. There are the health issues of large industrial corporations modifying food in order to make profit and affecting the health of people around the world. There is the convenience part. You know, as a woman in the kitchen for time immemorial, women were in the kitchen cooking and cleaning and processing food and preserving food in so many different novel and fascinating ways. And then when refrigeration and refrigerated rail cars came along in the beginning of the 20th century and you could get frozen food across the country into your refrigerator, and then the canning process was perfected, it freed people, freed women out of the kitchen for the first time in history. We didn't have to be there all the time, and I think a lot of women really took advantage of that fact, and the corporations saw an opening and they took it. We take so much for granted in this country. Every day of the year, 35,000 children die from poverty, the effects of poverty around the world. A lot of it is from malnutrition. They don't get the food because of the food system being globalized and who has the money and who's going to pay for it and how it's distributed and the political process and all those things. Faith is the most interior thing we have. Your relationship with God, as you understand God, no one can take it away from you. You could be forced to say things or do things, and it still may not touch your faith. Food is the same way. Eating food is the most intimate act that you can participate in. You're taking the earth and putting it into your body. It becomes you. The food that you eat affects how you look, how you feel, how you think. It affects your health, and at the end of your life, you return to the earth. It's a beautiful, virtuous cycle. The Buddhists have a belief, it's called emptiness, but I think of it as fullness. And it means that no one and nothing exists independent of anything else. We are all here. I'm here because the rabbi's here. I'm here because both of you are here. I'm here because all of you are here. And if we weren't all here, it would be something different than it is. We exist because everything arises interdependently with everything else. There is no me separate from any other part. And the food system is one identifiable manifestation of that endless interdependent cycle that we all participate in. One of the beauties of the local food movement to me is that it's bringing to awareness and bringing people in and involving them in anywhere from the most pragmatic, here's how you harvest a tomato and you start your own backyard garden, can the tomatoes, make Italian spaghetti sauce, have a potluck with your friends, to the most sublime recognition of our reliance on one another and the fact that you can't escape from that. You can pretend, but you can't really do it. So every decision that you make of the food that you buy impacts all those children who die every day. It impacts the social justice movement and the farm workers. It impacts the health of people. The soil is where the food comes from, and every dollar that you spend drives all those processes. And the awareness of that is, to me, the most important beauty of this entire process. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Julie. You almost made me cry.
Sorry.
It's all right. It is emotional. We have one microphone up there that is empty. Pastor or Reverend Kristen Regal from First Presbyterian called this morning, and she does have the flu, and it is not the St. Paddy's Day flu. It's the real flu. But I know I want to take a break before we get to Q&A, but I do know that there are a few folks here from First Pres. Would you like to say just a few words about what, I know that Pastor Kristen has been very involved in this program, and maybe you could speak on, if not her behalf, then maybe on your behalf, just a few words about First Pres and maybe your journey.
Okay, so I'll just come up here with the mic, and you
so
can.
It's Kathy here.
Okay, Kathy, here we go.
So I am a member at First Pres, and Kristen has taken it on as a special project. She's a resident minister, meaning she's temporary with us just for 2 years. But as a special project, she's taken on this issue of food injustice. And she began with an adult education class in the fall on food injustice, and then has continued by participating on the panel earlier this year, and by kind of shepherding those of us at First Pres interested in this issue along in some of the ICPJ events. We had a book study, which met, I think, 4 times. Twice in the evening, twice in the afternoon, of the book that everyone has been reading. And I just want to say that that book made it so clear to me how much we share as different faith communities, and basically that food is a gift from our God, our Creator God, and that it is a responsibility for all of us to share and make sure that everyone is fed. That's, you know, a core issue of justice, and to live simply so that others may simply live. At First Pres, we also have a food collection on Communion Sundays because of that symbolism which you mentioned, that we have been fed, and so then we take that upon ourselves to also feed others. We have recently switched to serving only fair trade coffee, which is a baby step, but I think an important one. Because we drink a lot of coffee at our church. We also participate in planting a garden every spring with an organization, and I'm sorry I can't remember the name, but it's in the Cass Corridor, and that will be happening this spring. And so that's just a couple of things that we are doing there. Did you want to add anything?
No. Said it well.
Okay, thank you, Kathy. And if we can pause for just a moment. I'm going to ask Jan Wright to come up and speak a little bit about some complimentary programming that's part of the Food Injustice Year. Jan is our chair of the Climate Change and Earth Care Committee at ICPJ. And
so we've heard some inspiring ideas and examples of things that people have done and can do tonight. And what I'd like to do, because ICPJ always tries to both educate and inspire people to action, is suggest some possible actions that you all, you as individuals, might be involved in. First, I'm going to mention a couple of things that groups can do, but that is less likely unless somebody here is part of a congregation or a group and gets inspired. We'd be glad to help you. We have some guidelines for earth-friendly potlucks to do. We have, a book study that was already mentioned, and we certainly could help people if they're interested in creating some of that. But what I'd really like to talk to you about is things you can do as an individual. We have 3 challenges. I'm going to pass around a sign-up sheet, and you may or may not be inspired to sign up, and either way is fine. And I'm going to pass around this, which will have a little more information about each challenge and also our website where you can find out yet more. But let me tell you just a little bit. 2 of the challenges have to do with your own eating and drinking, because it turns out that that affects the environment a lot, and more than I would have ever guessed until I started reading about it. One is a meatless challenge, 1 day a week asking people to not eat meat, because meat is a very, very, very big contributor to damage to the environment. The second one is a bottled beverage challenge, because the little bottles, plastic bottles, or cans for that matter, the individual servings have a pretty heavy effect on the environment as well. And we're not in either of these cases trying to say, don't ever do any of that, period. But we're saying, oh, look at what you're doing now. And some of you may already be like not eating meat or not eating a lot of meat, but think about where you are and think about what you might be willing to do. And if you might be interested in one of those challenges, there's a place to sign up for that. What I'd really also like to stress tonight is the policy level challenge. It's pretty simple. It's electronic. We may at some point ask you if you want to make a phone call or something, but mostly it'll be something you can do very easily on a computer. If you don't have a computer, talk to me. We'll figure out something else. But it's very important that we not only do things individually and as congregations or groups, but also at a policy level. So we will send out somewhere between 2 and 4 challenges. You can do any or all of them if you sign up for that. And we will need your email address to do that. And I want to just say that we have one in the works right now that we need people's signatures by next Tuesday. So if you're at all inclined, please sign up for the policy thing tonight. If you need to think about the other things, that's fine. But if you're at all inclined. And it has both an international and a local angle. And so if you're interested, sign up and you'll find out more.
I'll pass these around.
Okay, thank you, Jan. We are now going to open the floor for questions. I know some of you here have been part of a book study group that took a look at this book. This is a really interesting book. Tim has got maybe 5 copies.
4 copies, I think.
5 copies here at the Ann Arbor District Library. So if you didn't have a chance yet but are interested, we'll be hosting book studies throughout the year for our food and justice programming. It basically outlines 6 different faith traditions, and in the same format. It's a brand new book. It's very fun and easy to read. You don't need to read it start to finish. You could kind of just open it up and take a glance at it. But it talks about connecting the faith traditions in terms of the text and the traditions, the rituals to food, some menus, some recipes, and then some stories about action stories, what these communities are doing throughout the world around this work.
And could you just mention the title?
Yep, I can. It's called Faith and Food, Changing the World One Meal at a Time. I'm going to open this up for question and answers, but there is a woman in the audience that I know has read the book, has led the book group at First Unitarian Universalist. Her name is Kathy Muha, and I'd like for Kathy to say a few words. If
you could just raise your hand, Kathy, so I know. Okay.
So what is it you, what do you want me to say?
So your group read this book.
Yes.
And is very involved in food injustice at your community. Could you just tell us a little bit about that and maybe some of the reflections that came from the book study?
Yeah, actually, it started generating lots of ideas as we were having the discussion about things that we could do. We looked at throughout the book, there's about 6 or 7 different pages of action ideas, things that congregations can do, things that individuals can do. And we looked at all of those action, I mean, we glanced at those, and there's lots of wonderful ideas of things you can do in there. It was very interesting to find out what the different, how the different religions are different and yet the same. There's a lot of similarities between the religions and their thoughts on food and on feeding the hungry. That theme, you know, came up with the 4 up here. That the fact that we have food and therefore need to share food with those who don't. We were very taken with the Sikh religion that feeds, like, I don't remember, 30 million people or something on a regular basis, and they don't even have anywhere near that many people in their religion. That is such an important thing to them. But so yeah, we were, it was very inspiring.
Great, thank you. And her group actually had put together a whole list of sort of discussion questions for the book, so she sent it to me, and I'm able to share that if you do have a community that's going to read the book. So Tim has a microphone.
Yeah, if you have any questions, just raise your hand. I'll come around with the mic. Okay, I'm going to go right over here.
And you too, if you all have questions of each other, please.
Hi, this question's for Mr. Salum. I teach at Pioneer High School, and I have students that celebrate Ramadan. And I was very curious, what foods are they actually eating when they celebrate Suhoor and Iftan? Did I say it right?
That's pretty good. It's probably just as well as I could say it. So I'll actually define those words. Fasting in Ramadan is from basically sunrise, dawn to sunset. What you eat beforehand, usually people wake up in the morning and eat beforehand, drink some water. That is the first meal, suhoor. The meal in the evening at sundown is iftar. That's the dinner, if you will. There are no specific requirements as to what to eat during either of those meals. The idea is to basically give yourself as much nourishment as you think appropriate so you get through the day and fluids to get through the day while being able to carry out your regular duties throughout the day.
Another question?
We're here.
Okay, up here.
Rabbi Doberson, maybe you can talk a little bit about Hashweit laws and how they got started, what they are, why it's meaningful to you and your congregation, and then maybe Yusuf can compare that with halal food traditions.
Sure. The laws of kosher, the Jewish dietary laws, have their basis in the Torah. Several different books, Exodus mentions it, Leviticus, etc. They include laws restricting what meat and what seafood products can be eaten, and also the need to refrain from eating the blood of an animal and certain particular parts of the animal and certain fats that are in those parts. The rabbinic tradition following the time of the Bible, took those laws and expanded them considerably to include a prohibition against eating dairy products and meat together, and to wait a period of time after eating meat before eating dairy products. Codified the law concerning the lack of blood, not eating the blood, and also the concept of kindness to animals to lead to the idea that slaughtering had to be done in a particular way. And I know you mentioned that as well, that the laws are somewhat similar in that way, and brought in other aspects of the dietary laws. I wish I could say to you, this is the reason why they were instituted. We have no idea. Some people point to the fact that, well, it's for health reasons, but you can eat a strictly kosher diet, and it could be the worst diet for you. So I don't put very much stock in that, at least not now. Some people say, well, that wasn't true then regarding pig and pork products. Who knows? There was a sense that some kind of restriction in food in some way heightened our sense of awareness of what we were eating, and might also, in certain circles, have served as a way of separating from other people within the world, which was a big deal for our ancestors and hopefully is not as big a deal for Jews today. In fact, I would hope that it wouldn't be. But still, that somehow, because food was so much, social contact was defined so much by food then as it is now, there was an idea that, well, if you had strict laws regarding your food, then the chances of you mingling with people outside your community were not as great. Like I say, I don't particularly look at that now, but you're asking what the origin was. In terms of today, first of all, it's a matter of tradition. It becomes second nature for most people who observe kosher, to observe the dietary laws. I mean, you have to be careful. You look for labels on things. You ask questions in restaurants if, in fact, you do eat out at all. Some people won't eat out in restaurants, but those that do might be wanting to make sure of what products they're eating. And certainly within the home, it becomes something. But I think that the most important point about the dietary laws in Jewish tradition is the same as many other things, and I was interested in what you said about excellence. In Jewish tradition, the word might be considered holiness, and it might be exactly the same kind of concept, that our interactions with different aspects of our lives are supposed to increase the holiness, the wonder, the specialness, the uniqueness of what it means to be a human being, so that whether you're talking about family relationships, whether you're talking about business practices, whatever it is, you don't necessarily do what is expedient, quick, easy, but do something which causes awareness and raises that a bit. So certainly in terms of, I mean, many people would say, and I'm not going to argue with this point, that the ultimate form of kashrut would be being a vegetarian rather than worrying about the kind way to slaughter an animal, but at least it's a medium point of saying, taking the animal's pain into consideration. Also in terms of the way that the blessings that one would say before we ate, etc. But I just want to add one last point, and then I'm going to go on. There is a big movement today within different aspects of different parts of Jewish lives to include in the area of kashrut ethical and moral issues as well. So can a product be kosher? I'll just give you one quick example. This has been talked about for a long time. Can veal be kosher? If the calves are force-fed and kept in cruel ways, can that be kosher? Can if workers are subject to abuse in the course of the production of something, can that be considered kosher? Can it be considered kosher if it's not good for the environment, et cetera? Mm-hmm. And I think we have a long way to go with that. It's just beginning, but it has to be part of this as well. Mm-hmm. And it can't just be the matter of following the rituals. We have to go a little bit beyond that. So hope that answers your question.
So it's hard to follow up the rabbi. He's been leading people since before I was born. So in the Islamic tradition, there are two ways to think, two components to what constitutes halal food. There's the ritualistic side and what's forbidden and not forbidden, what's allowed and not allowed. So in the Islamic faith, for example, pork products are not allowed. Blood is also not allowed. And then there's the other side, which is this idea of food and justice. So I'm going to start with the first, the ritualistic side. I'd really like to echo what the rabbi said, is that it's a matter of faith in some ways. There may be issues that in the past, yes, pork was dirtier than it is now, and maybe now it is cleaner than before. But as Muslims, and part of faith in general, I feel, is to these post-after-the-fact rationalizations don't necessarily encapsulate the wisdom and faith that we try to show by relying and being obedient on God. On the food and injustice side, I'd reiterate the idea of food, being this encapsulation of justice in so many ways, because it touches relationships, our relationship with God, community, earth, fellow human beings as workers. And so the idea of just doing the right ritual, slaughtering in the right name of God, isn't sufficient to make something halal. Whether it's an issue of workers' rights, whether it's the issues of the animals being mistreated, whether it's an issue of just complete profitization of the industry of food manufacturing, each of those concerns need to be taken into consideration, even if they're not actually defined as part of the rituals. And to that effect, we are luckily in this country becoming more and more aware of this idea of this regrowth of organic food, or even beyond that, just free-range animals that are not necessarily just kept in cages, very limited opportunity, force-fed, and moving beyond that into animals that are given the opportunity to roam free, to eat the right, the grass or instead of grain-fed beef. And so the halal should encapsulate both the ritualistic side as well as this idea of our relationships with food, our relationship with animals and other human beings.
Okay. Another question.
How about of our panelists?
Someone? No.
With that, I want to thank you for coming. I want to thank our panelists for coming. And I want to thank the library for having us. Have a good night.